Well, good morning, everybody. Yeah, as Mike said, basically what I have to do today is describe to you some of the basic, really the background which you need to understand quantum information science, by which I mean quantum information theory, quantum computation. I am not going to get all that far into any of these subjects. As you can see from my list of things here, what you don't need to know about in order to follow this, I hope, at least, you don't need to know anything about quantum mechanics, computer science, or information theory. You might be asking, you know, what exactly do you need to know? The answer to that is that you will need to know quite a bit of elementary linear algebra. I'm going to assume that you remember, or at least have vague memories of pretty much your undergraduate linear algebra classes. And you'll also need that ephemeral quantity, the mathematical maturity, roughly of a beginning graduate student or North American graduate student. And with those two things, it's actually pretty easy to understand quantum mechanics. And once you've understood quantum mechanics, you can move on and understand quantum computation and quantum information really very easily. In fact, the way I'm going to explain quantum mechanics is basically using examples drawn from quantum computation. So here's a very rough guide as to what I'm going to do. I'm giving three lectures, 1 hour each. The very first one is going to be focused completely on the principles of quantum mechanics. I apologize in advance if, first of all, this is probably old material for many of you. Second of all, it's a little bit dry because it doesn't relate directly to the task at hand. However, we pretty quickly move along and get into some more interesting stuff. So in the second lecture, I'm going to give an introduction to quantum computation. And in a way, that also continues the goal of the first lecture because we keep being able to illustrate these principles of quantum mechanics at work. So hopefully it should reinforce some of the lessons learnt there. And the third lecture, well, up here I've written introduction to quantum information. Actually, that might be a little bit ambitious. In fact, really what I'm going to do there, it's going to be more of a hodgepodge of results that didn't quite make it into the first two lectures, along with a little bit about what quantum information theory is in general. Okay, so let me get into a discussion of what exactly quantum mechanics is. What is quantum mechanics? And the answer I'm going to give is that it's a framework for the development of physical theories, and the reason what it's not is a complete physical theory in its own right. When I first started learning about quantum mechanics, I had a little, in fact, quite a considerable misconception about what quantum mechanics was. I had this idea that it was a complete theory of how the world works. In fact, it's not a complete theory of how the world works. And to explain what I mean by that, I'll give you a few examples. Consider a computer, and computers have operating systems, and you load up the operating system, but that doesn't let you, process words or run PowerPoint or whatever. You need to add on some extra bits and pieces. You need to add on some application software. Let me just pause here for a couple of seconds. Right, I'm getting my laser pointer sorted out here. The battery's died this morning. My apologies. All right, so we've got these two components if you want a software program. So the operating system is like a framework into which you can fit a piece of application software, say Microsoft Word or GNU Emacs or whatever, and that application software sits on top of the operating system and makes use of all of the concepts, but you add in some extra bits and pieces. Well, quantum mechanics sits in relation to specific physical theories in a very similar fashion. So we have down here at the bottom quantum mechanics, and then sitting on top of quantum mechanics is some additional specific rules to describe specific situations. So let me give you an example of what I mean by this. A good example of this is the theory of quantum electrodynamics. What's quantum electrodynamics? Basically, it's an explanation of how atoms and or electrons and photons interact, how light and electrons interact. So what you've got, quantum electrodynamics, it includes quantum mechanics as part of it, but it introduces some extra rules describing how light and atoms interact. So those specific rules aren't actually prescribed as part of quantum mechanics. However, they fit within the framework that quantum mechanics provides. Really, all quantum mechanics contains is four mathematical postulates, very simple postulates, which lay the ground rules for our description of the world. And my task today basically is to convey to you what those four postulates are and to give you a whole bunch of examples. Now, I'm sure all of you have seen great big huge textbooks describing quantum mechanics, 500 or 1,000 pages long, and you might wonder, if quantum mechanics is only about four mathematical postulates, why are there these great big huge long books? And the reason for that is because, of course, we are interested in very specific situations in many cases. We are interested in how atoms and light interact, or we are interested in how atoms talk to one another. And the actual formalism needed to describe all of that and to solve all the equations is, in many cases, extremely complicated. So you need to learn a whole lot of technical tricks in order to deal with those situations. One of the lovely things about quantum information and quantum computation is that, in fact, the formalism is very simple. So you don't need to go through many of the contortions needed in the situations of interest in those great big huge textbooks. Let me give you a couple of other examples similar to the operating system and application software, just to drive home the point, which I'll come back to. One is role-playing games. So we've got, many of you are probably familiar with things like Dungeons and Dragons and whatnot, and you've got a set of rules which describe how the world works, but it's not a complete description of how the world works. You need extra things on top, some sort of specific scenario in order to fill it out. And quantum mechanics sits in relation to these specific rules, like those of quantum electrodynamics, in a similar fashion. And another very similar example, which may be familiar to many of you, and that is Newton's laws of motion. Newton's laws of motion don't tell you how bodies will interact necessarily, but they do provide a very serious set of mathematical constraints on how bodies must interact. And sitting on top of those are specific physical theories, things like Newtonian gravitation, which actually provide a precise specification of how bodies interact. Okay, so I'll come back to this point repeatedly. I want to talk a little bit about how successful quantum mechanics is. Part of the reason I'm doing this is a remark which one of the practitioners of quantum cryptography made to me about 5 or 6 years ago. He said that, many cryptographers come to him and say, look, I'm not going to believe you that your system for doing cryptography is secure. The reason is I don't believe quantum mechanics. Well, I think the state of evidence at the moment is that if you don't believe quantum mechanics, then you probably don't believe anything, because we've got more evidence for it than for just about anything else we know. It's an absolutely unbelievably successful theory. It explains, well, as far as we know, it explains everything. But it's critical for answering a whole bunch of interesting questions. Questions like, why do stars shine depend on quantum mechanics? How is the universe formed? It's critically dependent upon quantum mechanics. What's the chemical structure of DNA? Why is matter stable? All these questions depend absolutely critically on quantum mechanics, and no deviations have ever been found from quantum mechanics, and that's certainly not for lack of trying. There's certainly a Nobel Prize, and probably many in it, for anybody who actually does discover some real deviation from quantum mechanics. So a lot of people have spent a lot of time trying to find deviations thus far without any success. In fact, most physicists now are so convinced that quantum mechanics is part of the final truth, even if it's not the whole of the final truth, that any theory of everything, to borrow Stephen Hawking's term, will be a quantum mechanical theory. So it will fit within the quantum mechanical framework in the same way that quantum electrodynamics fits within the quantum mechanical framework. There are two clouds on the horizon. Life is not completely rosy, and physicists still are occupied at the beginning of the 21st century, not just with quantum computation and quantum information either. The first of these two clouds, which I'll come back to and describe in a little bit more detail, is that many people, and I, at least on Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays, include myself amongst this group, are worried about certain conceptual problems. Many of you know that Einstein had certain problems with quantum mechanics. And there's an issue that known as the measurement problem, which many people remains to be clarified. And I'll explain what the measurement problem is a little bit later on. As far as we know, this has no practical consequences, and quantum mechanics remains a perfectly good theory for explaining everything we see. But, it's a little bit bothering when you have these sorts of conceptual issues in the background. The second issue is perhaps somewhat more serious, and that is that we've got these laws of quantum mechanics, and we've also got a theory of how gravitation works, Einstein's general theory of relativity. is our current best accepted theory of gravity. And people who've attempted to unify gravitation and quantum mechanics have failed is perhaps slightly too strong a word, but they haven't exactly succeeded either. Many people are of the opinion that the basic problem is perhaps mainly a technical problem. Maybe we're just not smart enough to calculate the consequences of the theories we get when we write down naive attempts to unify gravitation and quantum mechanics. And other people believe that there's something more serious is going on and that some essential modification of one or both theories must in fact be made. So those are, I think, the two main clouds on the horizon for quantum mechanics, but I think they're quite far removed from the realms we need to worry about when we're thinking about quantum information processing and quantum computation. Let me move on and explain what I see as the structure of quantum mechanics, just to give you some sort of a feel for it. Forgotten I put that there. In any case, so what's the overall picture of quantum mechanics? The global picture. I said that there are four postulates. Well, there's three background things which you need a good grasp on. I've told you already that you need to know linear algebra, so I'm afraid if you don't, this might be a little bit of tough going. The second thing you're going to need to know is just a notational device. It's known as the Dirac notation, and I'm going to explain this today. All the Dirac notation is it's just a way of writing out linear algebraic concepts. There's nothing special about it. It's just a little bit unfamiliar to most people, or people who haven't had a physics training. So I'm going to spend a lot of time explaining that. And then, once you've understood the Dirac notation, you can understand the way physicists usually write the four postulates of quantum mechanics. And that's quantum mechanics. Let me describe for you what each of these four postulates are in sort of very vague terms. The first postulate is concerned with the problem of how you describe the state of a quantum, the state of a closed quantum system. There are a few interesting words here. First of all, there's the term closed. I'm talking about closed quantum systems. What do I mean by that? I mean a quantum system which is on its own. It's not interacting with the rest of the world. In practice, we actually often apply this to quantum systems which are interacting with the rest of the world, and that's usually a pretty good description. But the first postulate, really, strictly speaking, only applies to closed systems. But fortunately, if you've got a system that isn't closed, by just including a little bit more of the rest of the universe, you can usually make it or turn it into an effectively closed system. In fact, if you wanted to, you could include the whole of the rest of the universe, and that would certainly be a closed system by definition. So a couple of key words that will arise in that connection. I'm not going to explain what these are, but the way we describe our quantum states is using the term state vectors and state space. So we're going to describe the quantum state using state vectors, and they live in a location known as state space. Oh, I forgot one thing I forgot to mention. I want to talk a little bit about this term states. So what do I mean by the term quantum state? I think probably the best way of explaining this is to give an example. So physicists talk a lot about states in general. They talk, for example, about the state of the solar system. All they mean by that is the configuration of all the planets, how all the planets are located, what their velocities are, and so on and so forth. So they write down all those numbers, and that's a specification of the state of the system. So in general, they're very concerned with taking sort of snapshots in time and writing down some mathematical description which encapsulates everything you need to know about the system. And that's exactly what this state vector is supposed to do. It's supposed to encapsulate in some mathematical form everything it's possible to say about the specific quantum system. And then once we've got that description, various things can happen to it, can happen to the system, and there's a corresponding description of what happens to the state. Okay, so what happens? In other words, we're now interested in dynamics, the system changing in time. So how can we describe quantum dynamics? Well, that's what the second postulate tells us. In particular, it tells us how to describe the quantum dynamics of closed systems. And the key term here, which you'll hear over and over, is unitary evolution. People talk about the unitary evolution of quantum systems, and I'll explain what I mean by that a little bit later. The third thing, well, I've been talking about closed systems thus far. Closed systems aren't so interesting. If you're in a laboratory and there's a closed system on the bench, by definition, you're never going to be able to get any information out of it because it's closed. what you'd like is to be able to describe what happens when you measure the system, you know, when you perform some observation on the system. And the third postulate tells you how you can describe measurements. And the key term here is projective measurements. We say that you can do projective measurements on a quantum system, and I'll explain what those are later. Finally, the fourth postulate looks a little bit funny in this list. It doesn't look quite as fundamental. Is what happens when you've got a whole bunch of quantum systems. You know, say you've got two quantum systems, one belonging to Alice, one belonging to Bob. How do you describe states in the composite of those two systems? And that's what the fourth postulate tells you. And the key term there is tensor product. All right, let me get into a more detailed description of each of these postulates. The way I'm going to do it, it'll be the same for each postulate. I'm going to start with some very simple examples to illustrate the basic ideas, and I'll gradually work up until we get to the abstract sort of statement of the postulate, which hopefully will be clear by that time through the examples. So I'm going to start off with postulate one. How do we describe quantum states of a closed system? And the example I'm going to use, which you'll hear a lot about over the next few days, is the example known as the qubit. So for the physicists in the audience, I'll just say that this means a two-level quantum system. It's the simplest type of quantum system imaginable. So what is a qubit? Well, you're all familiar with bits, of course. You know what a bit is. It's either a zero or a one. But in actual physical terms, you've got some physical system which can be in one of two states. And, you know, for example, some sort of a switch or whatever, you could also consider some mechanical system that might be in one of two states. And you associate with those two physical states a logical zero or a logical one. Well, a qubit is very similar. A qubit is a physical system, a quantum system, which has associated with it two physical states that we label zero or one. And I use this funny notation around it just for convention. You can in fact imagine without much loss of generality that the notation isn't there. All this notation, the so-called Ket notation, means is it's to indicate that it's a quantum state. And these two states are known as computational basis states, and they behave as does classical information. You can do the same sorts of tasks with these states as you can do with classical information. What's different about a qubit, however, is that there are also some intermediate states between the zero and the one. And the states actually correspond pretty much to these points on this circle here. In particular, a general quantum state of a qubit can be written or can be thought of as a point on this circle and can be written as a linear combination of the zero and the one with coefficients alpha and beta. Let me say a few words about these coefficients. So we're now taking sort of linear combinations of these two guys. Alpha and beta can in fact be complex numbers. A lot of people find that hard to think about. It turns out that for the most purposes of quantum information processing, it actually doesn't matter if you just imagine that alpha and beta are real numbers. So you can think of these quantum states as being little vectors on this unit circle with real coefficients. Just lost my track a little. So you've got these two complex numbers specifying the state. I've drawn it on the unit circle for a reason, however, and that is that we've got this so-called normalization constraint, namely that the modulus squared of alpha plus the modulus squared of beta must be equal to 1. I'm not going to explain that constraint now. We'll come back to why that's true a little bit later on. The basic reason it has to do with is the fact that probabilities must sum up to 1. We'll see that why that's the case later. So when you think about qubits, all you need to do is think about states of this form. They're vectors. So let me state that in slightly more precise terms. So I'm going to give a rough form of the first postulate of quantum mechanics. So if you've got any closed quantum system, there's associated to it a complex vector space known as state space. And this is where the quantum states live. So that's the first part of the postulate. And the second part of the postulate is that the state of a closed quantum system is just some unit vector in state space. I say this is the rough form, but it's actually very close to the final form, which physicists all over the world use daily. An important point to make about this first postulate, and it harks back to what I was talking about earlier, is that in any specific system, such as an electron, quantum mechanics doesn't prescribe what the state space of that system must be. Rather, that's the job of some theory, such as quantum electrodynamics, to say what it actually is. And in practice, you know, what we're going to do is we'll work mainly with qubits. We're not actually going to refer to specific physical systems. We're going to work with this abstract entity, the qubit. And later on in the week, several people are going to talk about how you would actually represent qubits in real physical systems. We're just going to assume that that's been done and that we can work with these qubits in the abstract. Now, in the case of the qubits, the state space is just the pair of, or is just the set of two-dimensional vectors over the complex numbers. And you can write this in one of two ways, or you can think about it in one of two ways. The way I've written it on the previous slide is as alpha 0 plus beta 1. That's the Dirac-Ket notation. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, probably a much better way of thinking about it is in fact as just a two-dimensional vector. And you can go back and forth using this equivalence to understand, you know, whenever I write an equation like this, you can always translate it into more familiar vector notation and understand it from those points, from that point of view. Right, so that's postulate one. Yeah, quantum systems are described by unit vectors in some complex state space. Let me make just a few points about conventions I'm going to use through my talk. The first is that we're going to write vectors in the state space in this form. We'll often use the label psi. I've already pointed this out. I'd just like to note again that this is known as a ket. But when I say ket, you can always substitute the word vector. But slightly more important is we're always going to assume that the physical systems we deal with have finite dimensional state spaces. In other words, there's a basis for our state space with just a finite number of elements in it. Physicists often work with infinite dimensional state spaces. That's, or at least in my opinion, is really an approximation to reality. In any real physical system, you can always describe it in this way. So there's not much loss of generality by doing this, and it certainly makes the technical exposition a heck of a lot easier. And it's uniformly the case that people working on quantum computation make this assumption. It's not going to be too important for our purposes. So what this basically boils down to saying is that we're going to always be working with complex vector spaces over some number d of dimensions. So, well, let me write down a typical state vector then in the two different notations. So we've got our state vector, and you can either write this as this linear combination of states, which I'll label 0 up through d minus 1, or else you can write it out in the conventional vector notation. I've talked a lot about qubits thus far. People actually sometimes also talk about qdits. So what a qdit is it's just the d-dimensional version of a qubit. That's just a convenient term to remember. I should perhaps pause at this point to mention a few other items of nomenclature. I've talked about linear combinations of these computational basis states, 0, 1, etc. People use a whole variety of different terms for these coefficients. So sometimes they talk about amplitudes. Alpha 0 is an amplitude. Alpha 1 is an amplitude. Alpha 2 is an amplitude here. Or we say that alpha 0 is the amplitude for the state 0 in this expansion of psi. They also talk about superpositions of 0, 1, 2, etc. All the word superposition means is it's just the is just linear combination. It's the same as linear combination. And so those two terms are important to remember. Okay, so those are the yep.
Is there some sense of orthogonality?
I haven't talked about that. I will talk about that a little bit later. Basically, the way to think about these is the 0, 1, etc. is as orthogonal vectors. If you think of it in terms of this representation, you know, so just the state 0 would correspond to a vector with just a 1 up there and then a 0 everywhere else. Well, of course, that's orthogonal to the state 1, which would have just a 1 in the second entry and zeros everywhere else. So yeah, they correspond to orthogonal vectors with our usual understanding of the term orthogonal. Alrighty, talked about quantum states. Now I want to talk a little bit about quantum dynamics. This is a simple diagram, but there's a heck of a lot going on here. The way I'm going to explain quantum dynamics is using quantum logic gates. So already we're getting a little bit into quantum computation. As I say, there's a heck of a lot going on here. This is the simplest example of quantum logic gates, the so-called quantum NOT gate, very similar to a classical NOT gate. And this progress from left to right, this line here, doesn't actually represent movement through space. Oh, I should say that line represents a qubit. It doesn't represent progress through space necessarily. It really represents progress in time. So what we have over here on the left at this starting point is you have the initial state of some qubit. It moves along in time. Then something happens to it, the quantum NOT gate, which we represent by this boxed X for historical reasons. And then it moves along in time, and at some final time you have a final state of the qubit. And what I'll do is describe for you how the initial and the final states are related. They're related in the obvious way, or at least if you start with the state 0 and the state 1, all that this NOT gate does is it takes the 0 and turns it into a 1, or it takes the 1 and turns it into a 0, as you would expect. And of course, in quantum mechanics, 0 and 1 aren't the whole story. What happens if you start with some linear combination or superposition of the 0 and the 1? What does it do? Well, it behaves in the simplest way you might imagine. Linear combinations of 0 and 1 are taken to the corresponding linear combinations of 1 and 0. Why is this the case? Well, I'm afraid I can't really justify it in terms of anything simpler. This is just the way the world works. That's an important point, actually. Sometimes when discussing quantum mechanics with people who are just starting out, There's certainly a tendency to say why. Many of the things I'm going to say today, and this is a good example, although you can give explanations of sorts, you always end up with some question where you've just got to say, well, because. It's perhaps worth mentioning that quantum mechanics started, or the first inklings of quantum mechanics were discovered around 1900 by Max Planck. And it took 25 years of work by a very large number of contributors before quantum mechanics took its final form. I know that in 1924, Wolfgang Pauli, who was one of the main contributors, wrote a letter to a friend of his saying that he wished he'd been a juggler or a stage performer. Physics was far too complicated for him at that point in time. And that was a year before quantum mechanics took its final form. Things were very, very confused at that point. And the reason why it was confused is because everything was up for grabs, including, is quantum mechanics, does it behave in a linear fashion? All right, into that little digression. Because it behaves in this linear fashion, you can give the dynamics a matrix representation. You can just imagine that you've got some matrix which describes the action of the NOT gate on these states 0 and 1. So written out in the 0-1 basis, it has this form. In particular, this first column indicates the action on the 0 state. It just takes it to the 1 state. And the second column indicates the action on the 1 state. It just gets turned into a 0. In general, it's going to turn out, for reasons I'll give you a little inkling of, that any quantum logic gate, or more generally, any quantum dynamics whatsoever, can be represented as a unitary matrix, and this matrix here is unitary. I'll remind you a little bit of a few facts about unitary matrices on the next view graph, but this is the key point, that dynamics are in general described by unitary matrices. So let me remind you what a unitary matrix is. I'll do it in the two-dimensional case, and you can see how it generalizes. So you've got some 2x2 matrix with these entries A, B, C, and D. And we need to define an operation on this matrix, permission conjugation, or taking the adjoint. And the way we do this, physicists tend to use a slightly different notation than mathematicians do. We use a dagger to indicate taking permission conjugate or taking the adjoint. And a dagger is defined to be the matrix you get when you take A, take the complex conjugate, and then transpose the result. So in particular, for the 2x2 example, you end up with A star D star on the diagonal, and then the off-diagonal terms get swapped around and complex conjugated. Now, a particular matrix A is said to be unitary if it satisfies the following equations. A dagger is equal to A dagger A is equal to the identity. And pretty much uniformly, people tend to write unitary matrices using U, or if U's already been used, V or W, letters down towards that end of the alphabet. And just as an example, we'll take the X matrix, which we met before, the quantum NOT gate, and quickly check that that's unitary. So we've got to check that XX dagger is equal to the identity. Well, X is this matrix here. X dagger, you complex conjugate it, and then take the transpose, and of course it doesn't change. So this is just X squared. And you do a little bit of matrix multiplication, and you quickly see that it's the identity. Of course, the other equation, X dagger X, is also equal. The other quantity, X dagger X, is also equal to the identity because X dagger is equal to X. It's just the equation X squared is the identity. A few nomenclature tips. I often slip and use many different terms for matrix. In fact, this is done pretty widely. I've been talking about matrices thus far. Well, people often, they use different terms interchangeably in the quantum computation literature. And I think this sometimes causes some confusion. So they tend to use the term matrix interchangeably with the word operator, and often also with the term transformation or map, or even sometimes the term gate. So you've got all these different terms that may mean the same thing, and you've got to figure it out from context. So if I slip sometimes and talk about operators in particular later on, all I mean is matrices. Okay, so let's summarize what we've learned about quantum dynamics in the second postulate of quantum mechanics. And all it says is that the evolution of a closed quantum system is described by a unitary transformation. So in particular, if we've got an initial state psi at some early time, call it T1, and a final state of the system, psi primed, at some later time, call it T2, then these are related by some unitary transformation that doesn't depend on psi and psi primed. It only depends on the times T1 and T2. So any quantum evolution can be described in this way. Excuse me. Why unitaries? Well, the answer, of course, there is basically because, again. However, people have attempted to justify this in various ways. Some intuition may be given from the fact, remember I remarked earlier, that quantum states need to be normalized, they need to have length 1. I didn't explain why that was, we'll come back to that later, but let's just assume that quantum states remain normalized. Then the one reason why you would use unitary maps is because they're the only linear maps that preserve normalization. In other words, if we have this equation again, psi primed equals u psi, then the norm of psi primed is equal to the norm of u psi, and unitary maps have the property that they don't change the norm, so this is equal to 1. And we've preserved the normalization condition. Furthermore, they're the only class of linear maps which have this particular property. And I've just left that as an exercise for you to do, if you're so inclined, or if you haven't seen that result before. Prove that unitary evolution preserves normalization. Okay, let me give you a few examples of quantum logic gates. I'm going to talk about a class of logic gates known as the Pauli gates, which are very important in quantum computation and quantum information, especially for quantum error correction. We've already met one of them. It's the X gate, or the so-called NOT gate. It's also known as the sigma X or sigma 1 gate. And in particular, this set of matrices that I'm going to describe on this view graph are known as the Pauli sigma matrices very often. They're all single qubit operators or single qubit matrices, and well, XX, as we've already talked about. The second of the Pauli matrices is the Y gate, or the Pauli sigma Y, or sigma 2. And what it does is very similar. It takes 0 and replaces it by 1, but you get this extra factor out the front, often called a phase factor of I, and y acting on 1 gives you minus I times 0. So you have this nice 2x2 matrix representation, and you can easily go away and verify that this y operator is unitary. Third example is the z gate, also known as the sigma z or sigma 3, and it's denoted in this way in quantum circuits, quantum circuit language. And z acting on 0 simply gives you the 0 back, but acting on 1, it gives you back the 1, but with a phase factor now of minus 1 out the front. And in the matrix language, you can write it in this form. One final gate, which is sometimes referred to, but not always, as a Pauli gate, is the 2x2 identity matrix. And sometimes, for convenience, people just write that as sigma 0. It's often notationally convenient. Okay, these three gates, in fact, these four gates, really are tremendously important in quantum computation. They're very simple, obviously, but if you do many manipulations in quantum computation or quantum information, you usually end up knowing a heck of a lot about these gates. And in particular, you remember all their multiplication properties and various nice identities that they satisfy. I'll just give you a couple of examples of the sorts of things which people who work in quantum computation typically have at their fingertips. If you take the product of x and y, it's equal to I times z. And another identity that's very frequently useful, in fact unbelievably useful, you wouldn't believe how many things this identity is used to do in physics, is that x squared is y squared is z squared is I. So those are two exercises that you might wish to satisfy yourself with the truth of. All right. Moving along, we've talked a little bit about quantum dynamics. Now I want to talk about a third postulate of quantum mechanics, really the most complicated postulate, which deals with making measurements on quantum mechanical systems. So I'm going to start out with the example of a qubit. I'm just going to give you a very sort of rough description, and we'll gradually hone in and make it a little bit more precise. So we've got our general state of a qubit, alpha 0 plus beta 1. Unfortunately, the simplest obvious way of being able to measure the qubit is just being able to read off alpha and beta. It'd be great if we could do that. Unfortunately, quantum mechanics does not allow us to determine alpha and beta in general. I'm sure all of you have heard that quantum mechanics only allows us very restricted sort of access to the underlying states of the world, and this is a particular instance of this. We can only get very limited information about alpha and beta. So I'll describe to you one type of measurement that we could perform on our qubit. This is a type of measurement known as measuring in the computational basis. And for the purposes of quantum computation and quantum information, this is really the most important type of measurement which we can do. All other measurements really reduce in the end to performing this type of a measurement. So what happens then? Well, it's very simple. There's just a rule. What happens is when you measure in the computational basis, you determine whether your quantum state is either 0 or 1. You can only read out a single bit of information. And the probability of getting 0 is just alpha squared, and the probability of getting 1 is beta squared. It's very tempting at this point to say, why? Well, I'm afraid I'm going to give you the same answer as before. This is just because. In fact, for writing down this rule, sometimes known as Born's rule, Max Born won the 1954 Nobel Prize for Physics. Second, well, I've told you what the probability of getting the 0 and 1 results are. It also turns out that when you perform this measurement, you disturb the state of the quantum system. In fact, it turns out that this disturbance is unavoidable. You're not able to leave the system in this state, alpha 0 plus beta 1. Rather, when you measure in the computational basis, you either end up in the state 0 or 1, which state is determined by the outcome of the measurement. Let me explain this in slightly more geometric terms using the picture which I gave to you earlier of a qubit. So again, we've got all this set of states. I'm going to use a slightly different example. I'm going to use this state down here, which is the state 0 minus 1 up to this normalization factor of 1 over root 2 down here. And when you perform a measurement of the qubit, well, what you end up with is our way of thinking about it is the component along the zero direction, the alpha, or 1 over root 2 in this particular case, and you have a component in the one direction, which is minus 1 over root 2 in this case, and all you do is you square these two quantities to obtain the probabilities for getting the state 0 or the state 1. So in this particular instance, the probability of getting 0 is 1 over root 2 squared, so it's that length squared, and the probability of getting 1 is minus 1 over root 2 squared, which is also 1/2, and it corresponds to that distance squared. So you can sort of think geometrically as you're taking your state vector and you're projecting it down onto one of these two axes to obtain a final state 0 or a final state 1, and the respective probabilities are determined by the lengths or the squares of the lengths or the squares of the projections onto the axes. And that, of course, is where the normalization constraint, which I mentioned before, comes from. We need all the probabilities to sum up to 1, and so we must have that alpha squared plus beta squared is equal to 1 in order that probabilities sum up to 1. Right, that's one type of measurement. It turns out there's actually, well, many ways to skin a cat, I guess. There's many more general measurements that you can do on quantum mechanical systems. Let me give you sort of the most general description. Imagine that you've got some orthonormal basis for your state space, a d-dimensional state space. I'll call the states E1 through ED. So as a particular example of this, we can consider the states 0 and 1 for the state space of a qubit, a two-dimensional complex vector space. If you measure psi in the basis E1 through ED, then you get the result J with a probability which is just by definition the square of the inner product between the EJ and the state psi which the quantum system is in. This is not a result you're supposed to understand from some prior principle. This is it's a statement of a postulate. This is how the world works in practice, or we're able to perform measurements of this type, and it turns out that this is the way we describe measurements in quantum mechanics. So we talked about measuring psi in this particular basis. That's a very common term. Just a reminder of how inner products work. I haven't said too much about inner products thus far. So in the two-dimensional case, you take the inner product of this vector, alpha beta, with the vector chi delta, then you just get the number, the complex number, alpha star, the complex conjugate of alpha times chi plus beta star delta. This is a physicist convention. Very frequently in mathematics, what you'd have is you'd have the star on the chi and no star on the alpha. It really doesn't matter one way or the other. It's just useful to know that this is the way physicists tend to work, and so you can work out inner products in that fashion. Okay, so let me give you an example now of this more general type of measurement. Again, it's going to be a single qubit example. So we start with our canonical state. And we're going to introduce an orthonormal basis for the qubit, not the 0, 1 basis. We're going to introduce some other basis. So it will consist of two states. One we'll call the plus state, and it's just defined to be 0 plus 1 divided by this normalization factor of root 2. And the minus state, which is defined to be 0 minus 1 divided by the normalization factor of root 2. And if you compute the inner product of these two, you'll easily see that the inner product is 0. So they're orthogonal states, and they're properly normalized. So they're orthonormal. And in principle, we can perform a measurement in this basis. To figure out how we should describe that measurement or what goes on for this particular state, let's make a couple of observations to simplify this expression. So we'll just make the algebraic observation that 0 can be written as a linear combination of plus and minus, the appropriate coefficients, as can 1. We substitute these two equations up the top here, so we get psi is alpha plus beta over root 2 times plus alpha minus beta over root 2 times the minus state. And as a result, by the preceding discussion of measuring in a basis, if we perform a measurement in the plus-minus basis, we get the probability of getting the plus outcome is just this coefficient all squared, and the probability of getting a minus is equal to alpha minus beta squared divided by 2. So it's that coefficient squared. And that's an example of a different type of measurement which one can perform on a quantum system. Okay, I'm going to make a little bit of a digression at this particular point. I've been talking a little bit about inner products in the context of quantum mechanics. It turns out that the inner product is an incredibly useful notion, and I'm going to introduce a concept known as the dual of a vector or the dual of a state. It's a very useful notion, as this quote indicates. It often looks a little bit mysterious at first, or I certainly found it mysterious. But it will come in very handy later on. So the inner product is used to define the so-called dual of a vector psi. What do I mean by the dual? Well, if we've got a state psi or a vector psi living in this d-dimensional complex space, then the dual of psi is, by definition, it's a function, which I'll write using this funny notation. It's not the same as that notation. It's a new notation, which I'll also just say psi. And what psi is it's a map from the space of the d-dimensional complex vector space back into the complex numbers. And the way this map is defined is, if you take this a dual of psi and act it on the vector phi living in this space, CD, then by definition it's equal to the inner product between the state psi now, or the vector psi, and the vector phi. This is just something you have to get used to. Okay, so that's the definition of the dual. There's a nice simplified notation for the dual. So if we want to indicate psi acting on phi, then physicists tend to just write this and understand that this is the complex number, which is the inner product between psi and phi. Just as a very simple example, imagine that we take the dual to the state 0 of a qubit, and we want to evaluate it at the vector which is the superposition of 0 and 1, those coefficients. Well, you can work it out in the conventional notation as the inner product between this state, which is the vector corresponding to this dual, 1, 0, and this vector, which is this guy, and that, of course, is just alpha. Alrighty, that's the end of the digression. We'll come back to this later on, however, this sort of notation. Okay, we've talked about measurements now in some detail, and I want to give you the rough form of postulate 3, the measurement postulate, so-called. In particular, if we measure psi in some orthonormal basis, E1 through ED, then we obtain the result J with this probability, the inner product between the vector EJ and the state psi all squared. And that's just a postulate. Quantum mechanics. I've told you what the probability of getting result J is. I actually haven't mentioned thus far what the final state is after the measurement. In particular, well, as was for the case for the qubit, the measurement unavoidably disturbs the system, leaving it in the state EJ, which is determined by the outcome of the measurement. And that's the third postulate of quantum mechanics. In a rough form, I need to clean it up slightly, which I'll do later. Oh, excuse me. Let me talk. I mentioned that there are some conceptual issues that remain to be clarified. Probably the most commonly mentioned of these is the so-called measurement problem. Let me tell you what I think the measurement problem is. I notice Mike is sitting down here having a good chuckle. I think the reason why he's having a good chuckle is because if you ask any two physicists what the measurement problem is, they'll all claim that it's quite clear what the measurement problem is, but no two will agree on exactly what it is. So I'm going to give you sort of my version or my explanation for what seems to be bugging people, and other people can explain as they see fit. I've been told actually by many people that there is no problem, but they all give different reasons as to why there's no problem. Okay, so what's the basic problem? You've got a quantum system and you'd like to perform a measurement on it. So you've also got some measuring apparatus that you're going to use to perform that measurement. Now, if we believe that quantum mechanics, really is, the part of the final theory of the world, the final description of the world, then we all would also believe that this is a quantum system, or can be described using the rules of quantum mechanics. So we're going to perform some interaction between these two systems in order to perform the measurement, and we believe that interaction between the measuring apparatus and the quantum system can be described by postulate 3, this measurement postulate that I just described before. However, we also know that this quantum system and the measuring apparatus are part of the universe. There's the rest of the universe, and this entire guy is, it's a closed system by definition. So we should be able to use postulates 1 and 2 to describe everything going on in here, including what's going on in the quantum system and the measuring apparatus. And we know that, since it's a closed system, postulates 1 and 2 should be enough to describe it, and we should be able to deduce postulate 3 from postulates 1 and 2. Now, one way of phrasing the measurement problem is to say, how do you do that? How do you make that implication? Some people say it was obvious. Some people say this was all solved by Bohr in 1927. I know that, for example, there's a review paper coming out in Reviews of Modern Physics in the near future, which will explain modern opinions about it. I don't know. Some people seem to think this is clear. Other people think it's not clear at all. As an exercise for you. Actually, it was suggested to me before giving this talk that there should be an exercise before this, which is state the measurement problem. That might be just as good. Okay. Anyway, so that's one of the conceptual issues that remain to be clarified. In practice, however, as far as we know, we can use either this postulate or this postulate, and in all cases that are known, we seem to get exactly the same results, so there's no problem. Quantum mechanics works. It's just that it's a little bit unsatisfying that we can't make this implication. At least in my opinion, it's unsatisfying. Alrighty. Another slight digression at this point. I've been talking about inner products, and I've been talking about them because I've been talking about the measurement postulate. Earlier on, you might remember that when I stated postulate 1, how I describe quantum states, I said it was a rough form. Well, now that we know a little bit about inner products, I can give a revised form of postulate 1, which is a little bit more precise. And so here it is. It's exactly the same as before. We're saying that associated to any closed quantum system is some complex vector space. Actually, now I'm saying inner product space, known as state space. And the state of a closed quantum system is a unit vector in state space. So the only change which has been made here is to go from a vector space to an inner product space. And this is just a little bit more technically correct. In fact, people often call these inner product spaces Hilbert spaces. Now, in the finite dimensional case, there's no difference between an inner product space and a Hilbert space. And using the term Hilbert space is, I guess, a sign of greater addition or something. In the infinite dimensional case, there's quite considerable technical differences, but for quantum computation and quantum information, we almost never work in the infinite dimensional case, so it really doesn't matter which of these two terms you use. It's just useful to know both the terminologies. Yep. You can define vector spaces for which there is no inner product. A good example is the space of L1 functions, the functions for which the integral of the first power exists. As far as I'm aware, there's no way of defining. Yeah, it's more general. Yeah. Okay, so that's just dotting a few I's and crossing a few T's there. Let me talk now about how you describe composite quantum systems. So in particular, I'm going to use the example of multiple qubit systems to describe how you describe composites of more than one quantum system. So in particular, imagine that we've got a two-qubit system. Well, you do pretty much the obvious thing. You just write down all the possible states for two bits, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. And for a two-qubit system, there's a set of four computational basis states, corresponding to those four classical states, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1, and you can form superpositions or linear combinations of them with some complex amplitudes, alpha 0, 0 through alpha 1, 1. And all the postulates behave exactly as before. You have unitary evolution of these states, and you can define quantum gates for two qubits states. I'm going to talk about that in the next lecture some. If you perform a measurement of it, just to make the example a little bit more concrete, imagine you measure in the computational basis. So you get, for example, the probability of getting the outcome 0, 0 is alpha 0, 0 all squared, or alpha 0, 1 squared, or so on and so forth. Now, the generalization to a set of n qubits is very similar. In particular, you write out the set of all n-bit strings, which I'll denote x here, and you've got a computational basis state for each one of them, and you just form linear combinations of those with appropriate complex amplitudes alpha sub x, and that's how you describe a general quantum state of n qubits. Interesting observation about this is that there are 2 to the n of these complex amplitudes, and in order to just give a good description of this state would require on the order of 2 to the n classical bits of information. So in n qubits of quantum information, you've effectively got, to represent that classically would require roughly 2 to the n bits of classical information. Of course, you can't measure it directly. You can't perform a measurement and just determine these values, as I was mentioning before. So you've only got some sort of partial information, but you might wonder whether or not it's possible to use this apparently larger storage space to do anything interesting. And that's part of one of the jumping off points for quantum information theory or quantum computation. Carl Caves remarked in a 1992 paper that Hilbert space is a big place, and that's sort of shorthand for this observation here, that there seems to be Hilbert space for a small system, only n qubits, an enormously large number of states from a classical viewpoint. Now I'm going to describe for you postulate 4. This is the postulate which summarizes how you describe composite quantum systems. I'm going to use the so-called tensor product. This is a notion from linear algebra that I don't want to explain in too much detail. I tend to feel that it's best learnt by seeing examples, and you'll see a lot of examples over the next couple of lectures. I'll just state the postulate for the time being. Imagine we have, say, just 2 physical systems. Well, we know that each one of these physical systems, by the first postulate of quantum mechanics, has associated with it some state space. So is there any relationship between the state space of the composite of those two and the state spaces of the individual systems? Well, postulate 4 assures us that, in fact, the state space of the composite is just the tensor product of the state spaces of the component systems. And this tensor product behaves in much the way you would imagine. In particular, if you've got 2 qubits, you take their tensor product of their state spaces, C2 and C2, you're just left with the four-dimensional complex vector space. A whole bunch of different notations are used for the tensor product. If we talk about the tensor product of states of the individual systems, so a computational basis for this 2-qubit state space, you write often in this form, 0 tensor 0, 0 tensor 1, 1 tensor 0, 1 tensor 1. People get sick of writing this tensor symbol here, or they get sick of typing backslash O times in LaTeX, and instead they use a variety of shorter notations depending on how lazy they are, and you can see here it gets shorter and shorter and shorter. I've had people very confused on occasion, ask exactly what this is, or whether this is the same in the middle of lectures before. The thing to do, physicists in particular are usually very cavalier with the tensor product. They just assume it has all the properties that they'd like and plow on ahead. And very rarely does this cause any problems. So that's basically the sort of attitude I'm going to take today. Just a couple of properties to sort of point out that it really does have all the expected sort of properties. If you take this vector, the tensor product of V tensor W in two vector spaces, and you multiply it by some complex number Z, It's the same as if you'd taken the vector zv and tensored it with w, or alternately, you could have taken z times w and tensored it with v. So algebraically, it tends to behave in much the same way as you would expect. Addition distributes across the tensor product in both terms, and there's a whole slew of other properties. Basically, it tends to behave in the sort of ways you'd like, and manipulations tend to be quite transparent. Don't worry too much about these. You'll see me doing these sorts of manipulations and quickly catch on, I'm sure. All right. I'd like to just give a little summary of what we've talked about, a summary of quantum mechanics. So I'll go through each of the postulates in slightly shortened form here. So postulate one is how we describe closed quantum systems. A closed quantum system is described by a unit vector in a complex inner product space known as state space. Postulate two tells us how we describe the evolution of a closed quantum system, and it's just described by a unitary transformation. Postulate three, that's the complicated one. If we perform a measurement of psi in an orthonormal basis, then we obtain the result J with the probability that is given just by the inner product between the state EJ and the state psi of our quantum system, all squared. And furthermore, the measurement disturbs the system, leaving it in a state EJ, which is determined by the outcome. And the fourth and final postulate is that the state space of a composite physical system is the tensor product of the state spaces of the component systems. And that, in a nutshell, is what quantum mechanics is about. And everything else that you see in those big fat books is just elucidation of those postulates. I actually had the experience on, I think it was my first day of graduate school, of walking in to a lecture. It was actually on electromagnetism, not quantum mechanics, and having the lecturer write down four equations, Maxwell's equations, which are meant to describe the electromagnetic field, and saying, all right, if you can memorize these and feel you understand them, you may now leave. You know everything about quantum, about electromagnetism. Of course, there's a lot of technical stuff. We will make the postulates a little bit more concrete for you and provide you with something to take away of a more practical basis rather than these rather abstract postulates. But this really is the whole story. I think pretty much the majority of the rest of the week, people are not going to step outside of these boundaries. They're going to use these postulates, be using these postulates the whole time. Okay, thank you.